Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Greg Bresnitz.
And I'm Darren Bresnitz. We're the host of Snacky Tunes.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Off the air, I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. On the air, I get to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by having these conversations with some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Monday at 1 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. On today's show, I'm so thrilled to be joined by two of the most dynamic, productive, and prolific women in food, Jasmine Rodriguez of Hot Bread Kitchen and Gail Simmons of Top Chef Food and Wine, The Feed, all of the above, also on the board of Hot Bread Kitchen, so it's all in the family. Typically, when two guys come on the show that don't work together, I give them each a segment, but I thought today you guys have so much in common. We were just sort of catching up on including ballet lessons at the JCC. I thought it'd be fun to have you on together, so I came up with a list of parallel things. First, thank you both for being here.
We're really thrilled. Yeah. Thanks, Julia.
For listeners who might not be familiar with Hot Bread Kitchen, even though I tend to bring it up a lot during the shows, Jasmine, how would you describe it in a nutshell?
So Hot Bread Kitchen is a social enterprise. We're based in East Harlem, New York, and we exist to really help non-traditional entrepreneurs and enter into the specialty food industry and help women get their leg up in the baking industry and the culinary industry.
Awesome. And what kinds of things do you sell?
So what makes us really unique is that we sell a line of multi-ethnic breads that are inspired by the really diverse women who bake with us. So we make, you know, a nixtamal tortilla. We make two different Persian breads. We make these really luscious Mexican conchas, which is a sweet bread. And we have kind of all of these different ethnic breads. And we sell those to pay for a really unique, high-quality training.
Awesome. And Gail, I always think with someone like you, who I think of as having, I don't know, like a lot of pots on the stove, like I always think about when it comes down to like the immigration form at the airport, when you have like a little thing that says occupation, what do you fill in? How do you define what you do?
Well, a good question. At immigration, which I go through a lot these days, I always just say media consultant because
that's
it's
a good
easier
one.
Than yeah. explaining anything else. And if you bring up
good.
Food, I feel like then they want to search your bags. And I often have contraband in there, cheese and chocolate, nothing really that sketchy.
It's internet radio.
Exactly. I can do whatever I want. So that's kind of what I do. That's what I say. I think that's the easiest thing to say. But really, I've, you know, my roots are in food. I've always mm-hmm. worked in food, you know, for the last 20 years. I cooked and went to culinary school and then always knew that I wanted to do that in order to work in media. So that's in magazines. I've been at Food and Wine for 10 years. And now more than the time I spent at Food and Wine, just because of how my life works out, I spend a lot of that time on television.
Yep. Awesome. Yeah. So media consultant.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's great.
Everyone can be a media consultant. Yeah. That's the best part about it. Do you have a Twitter account? You're a media consultant.
The least descriptive, but a perfect way of describing
exactly.
what
you it do. Sounds enticing. It's mm-hmm. a good title. Speaking of immigration forms, the first thing on my list of parallels is to start at the beginning in Toronto. You're both from the same place. How have your Toronto roots influenced your career paths? Gail, I know you mentioned in your book, is it the theory that Canadians travel a lot but outside of Canada, but not within Canada?
Yeah. It is. We're both from Toronto and in fact have a lot of friends in common from Toronto, although Jessamine and I only met and became close here in New York, which is a shame because I kind of wish, I feel like I've known you my whole life. It's one of those friendships you get later in life mm-hmm. and find later in life when you realize this person you kind of like feel like you've known forever. But Toronto comes into play a lot in my life and I do feel like Canadians were an interesting bunch because we do travel outside of the country. We're great travelers, I think, by nature, Canadians, and we're incredibly worldly people. I never, when I was living in Canada, spent the time exploring my own country, unfortunately. And the problem is that often there's a brain drain issue in Canada, as we grew up calling it, where if there's something you really want to do, it, because it's just a small country population-wise and there aren't that many opportunities to do it, depending on what you want to do, you leave. And so there's all these really great creative people that end up leaving Canada. And that can be hard too, because Canada is such a great place. And since I left 16 years ago, it certainly has, you know, grown even more. But there is a pretty great expat community of Canadians, Torontonians for sure, in New York, and a lot in the food industry.
I would say a lot in the food industry and a lot in the media industry. Yes. I have always thought that Canadians have kind of a larger than reality impact on American media, and I think it comes from growing up from the outside looking in. I mean, especially when we were growing up, you know, American media, our TV, half of it was American, but the commercials were blipped out. And, you know, we've kind of consumed American culture, but with one step of distance, which I think makes a lot of Canadians I know really interested in American culture and media, and I think set up well to kind of comment
on
it.
That's so interesting.
And I think in terms of what I do, I have always said that being Canadian, I think, you know, I think Canadians by definition appreciate the immigrant culture. Mm-hmm. I think baked into our DNA, very much stated in kind of our national ethos, is this sense of kind of, you know, the contribution of immigrant communities. And so very much what I do at Hot Bread Kitchen, I think, is very Canadian in ethos, mm-hmm. which is why maybe it didn't take too long for me to attract Gail to my board of directors, or maybe she's just like an awesome person and wanted to be part of it, but it doesn't take...
And I really like to eat bread.
And you like bread.
There's that. But yes, all of those things.
Canadians get it. You know, mm-hmm. I think in growing up in Toronto, it's not even political, but it's just like you naturally appreciate that, you know, you live in a community where on any given block, there's a bagel store next to a Filipino food store next to, mm-hmm. you know, a Russian bakery. And that's just kind of how things work there yeah. because of different immigration policies. So I think what I do at Hot Bread Kitchen makes sense in New York. I feel like it's a great place to have launched it in New York City, but it's like bringing a little bit of our Canadian roots into the U.S.
It's true. I've never thought about it that way. And I will say this is broad. This is a bit of a generalization, but there is this very subtle difference I notice between kind of immigrants in Canada versus immigrants in the States, which is in Canada, I find in general, you identify first as an immigrant and then as a Canadian. Whereas I feel like in America, if you come to America as an immigrant and you've made it to America, you identify with being American first.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So I always say, I'm not an American, but I'm a New Yorker. Because I'm not yet a citizen of this country. but, you know, even in Canada, I'm actually a first-generation Canadian. Mm-hmm. My father's from South Africa, and he moved to Canada in his 20s. So I identify actually as being first generation Canadian. I identify as being South African, and my mother's side is Eastern European. So I kind of identify with those roots first and then second as Canadian. But I feel like in the States, it's a little bit different. It's kind of like because America, this American dream is so pronounced that if you kind of make it to America, you set that up as like you're American
yeah.
first
you
and whatever yeah. else comes after.
Yeah. And I think how that relates to Hot Bread Kitchen is what we're doing is we're building esteem in immigrant cultures. We're saying to women in the program, your bread is A, delicious, and B, there's a market value for what mm-hmm. you make. And that is, for many of the women in the program, an incredible learning. I remember the first time that we sold M7 at New Amsterdam Market, this kind of flaky, buttery Moroccan bread that has in many ways become our calling card. There was three women from Morocco who were baking with me the night before we had that market, and they made 300 pieces of it, and I was like, okay, that's great, now bake another 300 because I think we can sell yeah. it tomorrow. And they were like, oh, you crazy white lady, there's no way we're gonna sell 600 pieces of M7, nobody knows what this bread is. And I was like, trust me, we're going to sell the heck out of this bread because it's delicious. And New Yorkers are craving kind of authentic stories and foods from different cultures. Of course, by noon, we had sold out all the emsemen, and the three of them were left, you know, a little bit jaw-dropping. And I think feeling that much more proud of where they were from.
Oh, that's such a good story. Sort of I've never heard that before.
Genius of Hot Bread Kitchen, of celebrating all that individuality. And it's also just so delicious. I mean, it sells itself. How many pieces of emsemen do you guys make, like, per market day?
Yeah, so we sell a ton of it. We make now about 2,000 a day.
Wow. So. It's like I've seen
you haven't eaten it
7 days a week.
Most insanely delicious bread you've ever had.
I've had the honor of watching them make it firsthand, and it's very much a labor of love.
And you've made it.
Yeah,
you've watched them make it, and then you've made it,
and it's
with great success.
Like, surprisingly, it's not too hard to make. I was pleased about that.
A lot of pachka.
Yeah, exactly. you have to not be afraid of using your hands. I think that's a big theme. Speaking of sort of where you're from and who you're from, I think another thing you guys have in common are your mothers in a little bit of a way. I think, Gail, from what you've read and Jasmine, I mean, from what I've read that you've written, and Jasmine, from what you've told me, both of you come from pretty wonderful, very intelligent, articulate women who also happen to be very great cooks and bakers. I was thinking we have to schedule for your mother to make Gail's mother a challah in exchange for a plum tart.
That's a good idea. They're signatures.
I'm sure our moms would actually get along. I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah. I bet our mothers have met.
I'm sure they have.
At the JCC.
JCC. The Toronto JCC, the North JCC, or the South JCC, where I, by the way, went to Sunday school when I was, you know, six or whatever.
I'm wondering how would you describe how your mothers have both influenced you?
In enormous ways. I in my book, I speak a lot about my mother because you can't not, if you are delving into your own psyche, a lot comes out about your mother, whether you want it to or not. The biggest sort of takeaway about my mother was that, my mother ran a cooking school when I was growing up. It was her way of staying at home, working from home, while she was raising me and my older brothers. And she also wrote for the Globe and Mail, which is Canada's biggest newspaper. And she wrote a food column for years. And it was amazing. I spent, my whole childhood in her kitchen watching her teach, watching her cook. She was an incredibly spontaneous cook in a way that I still am sort of in awe of. She had a little bit of training, but it was mostly instinctual. And she was an ambitious, adventurous cook and was, spending hours searching through Chinatown long before that was what people did, in the 70s in Toronto. Toronto, by the way, has the largest Chinatown in the world outside of China, I believe. It actually has three Chinatowns because it is such a massive Chinese population. Anyway, so, she really inspired me that way. But then still, it never occurred to me growing up that that was a career, even though my mother did it as part of her livelihood until I was about 12 years old. It still never occurred to me that was something that you could kind of do to make a living. I went to college. I graduated. I wanted to go into international relations and anthropology, like kind of international development relations. And she sort of stuck in my brain, and I kept going back to food, and I kept cooking, and I kept ultimately deciding I wanted to write about food. And all of my mom's friends would say, "Oh, you're just like your mother," and that would make me furious because what 22-year-old wants to be told they're just like your mother? That's like the worst thing you can tell someone who is at the start of their life, the start of their adult life. And now I realize that it's the greatest gift and the greatest compliment because obviously this all comes from my mother. What about you, Jasmine?
My mother was an English professor. Mm-hmm. And when I was 12, my father passed away and my mother became a single mother. And so I think a lot of what I learned about kind of strength and perseverance and positivity and just, she set for us before that event and after that event, just an incredible model of like keeping it all togetherness and just perseverance.
Entrepreneurship.
Yeah. Entrepreneurship. I feel
like every single mother is an entrepreneur.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think so. And she never highlighted those things. She never, you know, she had a, she taught at Centennial College, a community college in the city. And she just, you know, loved her work and loved her family. She loved to cook. My father did, you know, half the cooking, but my mother never, you know, complained about it, made these wonderful, glorious meals, baked challah on Fridays, and somehow kind of kept all these things together. Again, the it's only in my 30s that I'm able to really tip my hat to my mother, and maybe only after having children, that you can really recognize what it meant to have done that and what a kind of intuitive or kind of internal role model she'd become. And now I still have trouble probably acknowledging the full impact of that, but she was an inspiration without even knowing it, and in like a very
really
humble way,
led by example.
Is your challah recipe that you make at Hopper Kitchen your mother's challah recipe?
I like to say it is.
Let's just go with that.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bread that I've been very invested in. Our challah at Hopper Kitchen is now much more complicated than what my mother made. Yeah, it's industrial, and we use pre-fermented doughs, and we do things in a different way. But it's definitely inspired. And if an ugly challah does not fly at Hopper Kitchen, because it's something that I feel very personally invested in.
Great.
I love that. I'm wondering also about your backgrounds, because I think both of you, another thing you have in common is you're both very well-traveled. You both speak multiple languages. It seems like this comes from the sort of like international influence of being a Toronto native. Was that something, sort of travel and speaking different languages, is that something you guys both learned from your families? Was it encouraged by your families? Was that something you came to on your own?
My family traveled a lot. Both my parents were teachers, and so we had summers off, and so we traveled at first in Canada a fair amount, and then we traveled in the U.S., and then, you know, when I was a little bit older, we did a few trips to Europe. It was something, you know, but I think being from Toronto, you know, visiting Chinatown, going to Little India, there's all of these areas that you can travel internally, and my family did that kind of stuff, which made me very interested. And when I was 16, I started traveling a lot on my own. And it definitely wasn't something that my mom encouraged, but it wasn't also something that she discouraged. And now, again, having kids, I can only imagine how scary it was to have her 17-year-old take off to South America for 6 months on her own. And I, you know, pre-cell phone, she would go weeks without hearing from me. And I know she didn't sleep for multiple years when I was kind of sowing those oats, but I think it was a good lesson about just kind of giving your kids what they need and then watching them blossom with it.
Wow, I'm like nervous now because we both have daughters, and the thought that they're going to do all this stuff.
So but at least their cell phones.
True enough.
They have GPS trackers.
Right, exactly. By then, we'll have a chip, right, buried in their arms. Poor children. Yeah, I mean, my father's from South Africa. And so a real introduction to travel for me was going back to South Africa. My first trip, I was 6, and we pretty much went every 3 years or so. Until I was in my 20s. So I've been, you know, 8 times, let's say, in my life. I haven't been since I was 23, which actually makes me very sad because it means my husband's never been. And so we're working on getting back. But that was really the incentive for travel originally. But I think also my parents traveled an enormous amount, still do, really. My father actually just called me at 4 o'clock this morning from Barcelona, forgetting the time change. my parents are great travelers. My mother traveled a lot in her 20s, really ahead of her time. She did a master's degree in Belgium, in international politics when she was 21, which was unheard of at the time. It was 1960. And so that was completely, completely unheard of for a woman to kind of do at that time. And then spent 6 months traveling around Europe and Israel on her own. And my father, you know, left South Africa when he was in his early 20s to ultimately go to Canada. And so I think they had that itch always, and they instilled it in us. My parents, that's where they spent their money. My parents never we were lucky that we were, you know, raised very comfortably, but they didn't care about a lot of the things that a lot of my friends' parents cared about, cars and clothes or whatever it was. My parents, all their money that they had saved went to travel with us. And that was extraordinary. I didn't even really appreciate it at the time, but, you know, when I was very young, we went to the Middle East, we went to Costa Rica. We spent a lot of time traveling around the States. And then South Africa and Southern, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, because that was sort of what they loved. And then ultimately a little bit to Europe, as well. And then when I was, 18, I spent some time in the Middle East, and then my father's family immigrated to Australia, in the early 90s, sort of at the end of apartheid. And so my whole family now is in Australia. So that gave us another reason to travel. And then I decided, I guess, almost subconsciously that I needed to figure out a way to make that part of my job.
Yeah.
And I finagled that. I don't even know how, but it's been rewarding part, I think, of what I do is being able to travel around the world and discover another culture through its food.
Yeah, I think it's something you guys both so much have in common. So yeah. I was just curious because I think when you grow up knowing the world is much bigger than just you or where you live, I think ultimately you tend to find a really sort of great place in it, as you both have. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back with more of the list of things you guys have in common.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow, with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And Point of Origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian, and today I'm with Gail Simmons and Jessamine Rodriguez. I think we're all very intrigued by this cheese. It was just advertised.
That's amazing.
So along the lines of this list of things you guys have in common, another big common denominator is Chef Danielle Ballou. Gail, you worked with Danielle for how long?
Almost 3 years. Three years.
And your title was...
Special events manager, I believe. You know, I sort of did a number of things.
You were a consultant.
Yeah, I was a media consultant. No, I think I was his special events manager. Mm-hmm. But at the time that I worked for Danielle, it was a very small company, much smaller than it is right now. He had 3 restaurants in New York, was just opening. I opened his Palm Springs restaurant with him, and he was about to open his first Las Vegas restaurant. But otherwise, he was really like a New York restaurateur and only, and you know, it was a small executive crew besides all of his servers and cooks and everything, and so we all sort of did everything, which was amazing. I never planned on working for Danielle. It was one of these things. I had been working for Jeffrey Steingarten at Vogue magazine, and around 9/11 I decided it was time to leave Jeffrey, and the world was sort of in upheaval, and it was very hard to find a job in media. And my first thought was I would just go work, you know, from Jeffrey. I would go to work at Food & Wine magazine or Gourmet magazine, and I'd continue my journey as a food writer. But the world was in a very difficult place, especially for someone not American who needed a visa.
Yeah.
And I'd come to know Danielle through Jeffrey. And when he offered, I went to pick his brain because he just knows everyone. And he's such an icon. And he'd been so generous to me through Jeffrey. And he said, well, why don't you come work for me? I need someone to help my market. He had an in-house marketing and PR director, an incredible woman named Georgette Farkas at the time. She was with him for about 17 years or more even. And she needed help writing cookbooks, doing PR, marketing, opening restaurants, doing all of his events, his charity work. They were just growing really quickly. And so I went on and just sort of jumped in and did all of it, which was, I like to say that Danielle gave me an MBA in the restaurant industry because it was the first time I kind of learned what it takes to run restaurants as opposed to just eat and write about it.
And Jasmine, you spent time there.
Yeah. So I had this idea for Hot Bread Kitchen early on in my career, and then I was like, oh, somebody else will do it. Somebody else will do it. Somebody else will start an immigrant women's baking collective. And when no one else would do it, when no one else was doing it, I was at a point in my career when I wanted to try it. But then I realized that I didn't know how to bake. And so my boyfriend, now husband, was working in front of house at Danielle. I mean, I think Danielle just serves this amazing role as kind of, you know, it is a training place for so much talent. And my husband is now in wine service, but he had worked in front of house as an assistant sommelier and had left at the time, but he knew the head baker there. So Mark Fiorentino is the chef boulanger, or was the chef boulanger at Danielle for many years. And I did not know anything when he took me on. I mean, I just knew the terminology, really, and I didn't have any baking skills. But Mark is just a tremendous human being and a benevolent soul. And I think that he recognized the value of creating the talent pipeline in women. And I think he was sick of hiring dudes in the bakery that just like weren't going to make it work for him. And so he took me on. He taught me a lot. So I apprenticed there for like probably 18 months or 2 years, moonlighting while I was working another job during the day. So I'd go in super early. And then at a certain point, he hired me. And I think it was probably like $6.50 an hour, something like ridiculous low wage. But I was the first woman that had ever been hired in the bakery at Danielle. And that was a huge feather in my cap. And it allowed me to really go out and talk about Hot Bread Kitchen from a place of authority as opposed to being kind of a non-baker with this crazy idea.
No, I think that's so amazing. I think it's true to another thing I think you guys have in common.
Wow. We're twins.
I think you both really do approach your work with a deep understanding of the subject matter. And just as you were just talking about, Jessamine, about really having this idea and then realizing you needed the education in baking and going ahead and getting it. I think it's so amazing when I see you at Hot Bread Kitchen. I know, like, I mean, if everyone called in sick, you could bake all the breads. like you know what your subject is. And Gail, when I watch you on television, I know I personally trust your judgment because you have experience. You've cooked in kitchens.
Faking it off. No, thank you. I think it's. Oh, sorry. You probably had a question. I remember I have this sort of moment in my young life when I had graduated from college and didn't know what I wanted to do. And I knew I wanted to work in food. I kind of realized I wanted to write about food. Being a food writer sounded so romantic and fantastic. You get to just like go to restaurants and write about them. At least, you know, this is many years ago, before the food industry was as broad and rich as it is now. Really, the term food writer kind of only meant one or two things. It was a much smaller industry. And so I thought I could just go do that. And I was working at a magazine in Toronto and then at a national newspaper, the National Post, when it first launched. And I worked in the entertainment section, the weekend magazine that was not unlike New York Times Magazine, in that it had all of the, like, it had a lot of lifestyle stuff, entertainment, food, travel stories. And so I found myself following the food editor around and asking a million questions and trying to get him to let me to write. And he did let me write a little bit. But after about a year, I felt a little stuck and asked him what he thought I should do. How do I become a food writer? Because all the major food writers were never leaving their jobs. They were all about 50 years old and they had the cushiest jobs. And there was like six of them in Canada. And what else could I do? Because there wasn't a ton of places to write about food. And this was before the blogosphere, exactly. Literally. And he looked at me and he said, well, if you really want to write about food, you should probably learn something about food. You don't know anything about food. And that was sort of like a revelation to me. Because you think, what do you mean? I eat. I like food. Isn't that all you need? Well, no. I didn't know how to cook. I mean, I cooked for myself and I loved cooking, but I had no professional training at all in cooking. And he said, look, if you really, it's just like any other medium. If you want to write about politics, you need to be where the politics are. You have to be in Washington. You have to be in Ottawa if you're a Canadian. If you want to be a war reporter, you need to go to the war. You need to be on the front lines of anything so that you can speak that language with authority, or else who's going to believe you, and exactly. Why should you do it? So that's when I moved to New York and went to culinary school. And then after culinary school, cooked in restaurants for a while, because you realize that the language of a kitchen is so different than the language of just eating. Everybody eats. So in some senses, everyone has an opinion. Everyone should have an opinion about food. But to speak the language of kitchens and to understand the technician or the kind of the technical aspect of what's involved in cooking, the science, and especially of baking, I have to say, which is a whole other universe, as Jessamine well knows, it takes work. I mean, that's like, it's like calling yourself a doctor the day you graduate medical school. You know, I'm still not letting you perform open heart surgery on me. And so I still believe, and for like young people coming up, when they ask me, I want to be a food writer, I want to do what you do, I want to be whatever, what should I do? Cook. Like, just because you like to eat and you can cook in your home kitchen, if you want to be an authority and have people take you seriously, I do believe that's the strongest, also, most important thing.
If your job is to be a translator of that world to another world, you have to know how to know both languages.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of like that's what I certainly call myself. Like, I'm definitely not I'm not a restaurant critic. I like to joke that I'm not a food critic. I just play one on TV. but I'm a translator. I'm a cheerleader for the restaurant industry.
That's great. I love that. I'm curious about, I really admire how you both sort of found work and have created work for women. I think of the feeling when I walk into Hot Bread Kitchen the same as I felt on my first day as a student at Barnard, which is like an all women's college where I went to school. And it was, you know, strong women aren't the exception. They're just the majority. That's just who you're with and who you're surrounded with. And Gail, you've been with Food and Wine for 10 years, you said, and it's a publication that's so driven by women on both the editorial and the publishing side. Mm-hmm. How important is working with women to both of you?
Sort of everything, in a way. I mean, the irony of that is that the restaurant and food industry is obviously factually still dominated by men for a million reasons. You know, this is a statement. You know, I don't know the exact percentage, but it's something like 10 to 15% at the max of the restaurant industry is women. So we still have a long way to go, but we've certainly made strides. And I think that there's so much great opportunity for women in the food industry, and so many creative outlets now that weren't even available to either of us 15 years ago, that you sort of had to create your own thing. And now more than ever, I think that's true, that there's more opportunity for women who want to create their own path in the world of food. I work, I'm an entrepreneur in residence at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and I work with them. They have it's an entrepreneurial school, and every student at the school has to create a social enterprise by the time they're in their sophomore year. So they can't just sort of start a hedge fund or something. They need to start a business that has a social conscience. And,
that's awesome.
And I spend a lot of time, they have an institute there, the Center for Women's Entrepreneurial Leadership, to foster women entrepreneurs. And I think that's why I was saying, like, every single mother is an entrepreneur. I think that women by nature are such fantastic entrepreneurs because they are so used to creating opportunity, just because we're scrappy and we have to take, we're great at multitasking and taking what we can and turning it into something really fruitful. So that's what I hope to do.
Are you running that program?
I'm going to make her come there one day.
Gail always tries to connect.
I do connect, and I have. I've sent women to her, you know, over the years.
You know, it's interesting. Like, the question is such an interesting one, and I forgot you went to Barnard, but, like, I hire people from Barnard and connect with people, women from Barnard, as much as I can, because
it's a good place.
It's a good pool, and it's a good woman.
There's a lot of Barnard women in the food industry. It's an interesting sort of
and in places of power. I mean, I think to not acknowledge that Gail and I are the exception, to sit here as representatives of the, you know, food media and the baking industry as women, you know, the reason why I think we're exceptional is because we are in a minority. Mm-hmm. And I didn't create Hot Bread Kitchen because I don't love working with men. I do. But the reality of it is that I've created a place where women feel comfortable working, and we've been able to, because of that, cultivate a lot of talented women on our team. Awesome. You know, plenty of talented men. I want to just, about this issue of women and entrepreneurship. So we run two programs. We run the bakery, and then I run a culinary incubator program. Or we run a culinary incubator program, I should say.
I support Jessamyn running a culinary incubator program.
And in the incubator right now, we have 85 businesses. We've supported 85 businesses.
I was going to say that grew.
Yeah, no, we support 45 businesses. Okay. Yeah. We have supported 85 since we launched 3 years ago. 80% of them are women-owned. 65% of them are foreign-born. And we've graduated 10. You would hope that 80%, that 8 of those 10 businesses that we were graduated were women and minority-owned. The reality of it is that 8 of them have been male. Owned. So there's a real contradiction here, right? I've created this wonderful space for women. I started an incubator to help female entrepreneurs. And even without, you know, with all the resources, with the talented board of directors that we have not fast-tracked those women to grow their businesses. Graduation means opening your own space, raising the capital to work with a co-packer. Graduation takes many forms. And it's almost from a place of shame. I feel like we're failing the female entrepreneurs in that program in helping really crack the code on why
ceiling.
That's not working. Yeah, cracking the
so what do you think? What do you think are some of the factors?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's such an interesting fact.
We really need to tap into this to thought leadership on it. I don't think we're doing enough. You know, I focus on hard skills. I'm like, if you are accounting, if you are, you know, charging enough, if you have access to the right, you know, expertise on branding, packaging, all that kind of stuff, you should be successful. And we haven't focused on the intangible, softer pieces of it. So what does leadership feel like? What does it mean to be a leader? What does it, how do you factor risk into the complicated role that is being a mother and an entrepreneur? We don't deal with that because I'm just sort of tactical in how I think about things. But in really having this realization, and I'm in this moment of kind of reconceptualizing how the incubator works, I think we need to like go to the experts and say, like, what are the things? I mean, I'm a big believer, like, subsidized childcare, and this is the Canadian in me.
Yeah.
Like, subsidized childcare, social welfare system would really help a lot of the women who are hoping for being successful. But I think there's other kind of self-imposed barriers that we put up as women in the industry.
It reminds me of when I was in college, so sort of going back to this Barnard moment, I had a friend say to me, and it's always stuck with me, just being in this atmosphere, as I think everyone at Hot Bread Kitchen is, this atmosphere that's so supportive of women. And she said to me once, we had just left some talk with, I don't know, some inspiring woman, and I can't remember who, and the friend said to me, like, I know, like, I see the glass ceiling, I get it. I just, like, no one, I don't know how to fly. Like, I need someone to teach me how to do that. And I feel like it's that last little just cracking the code kind of thing.
And
it's an interesting.
I have this awesome babysitter who's a Barnard babysitter.
Best resource.
It's an
amazing
right?
program. Yeah.
And so she's a Barnard babysitter. She's worked with me. She's now a sophomore, and she was just there on Saturday night. And she told my husband and I, she's Latina from Brooklyn, and she told us that Barnard is only 4% Latina in this city. So you think about who Barnard is supporting, and they do a great job of supporting women who need it and shattering that glass ceiling or hoping to figure out how to fly. But that also only serves a very limited proportion. And so what we're struggling with at Hot Bread Kitchen is, okay, even, you know, people who, you know, are foreign born or minority or dealing with other limitations, like what's the even bigger lift to really diversify the food industry? And it's a huge lift.
Well, Hot Bread Kitchen's certainly a piece of it. That's for sure. Piece of the answer. It is.
I mean,
that's why
more.
I was drawn to work with you on your board from the beginning, because it tackles some of the most complicated social, socio-political issues that women face today. I mean, this is a much broader example and a more complicated, well, not more complicated, it's all complicated, but a different set of complications. But I get that question a lot because the TV I do Top Chef has been on the air for 12 seasons. Okay. And that's something we're very, very proud of. We started that show in, you know, we first shot it in 2005, never thinking we'd make it to a second season, let alone a 12th. And so we're very proud of the show. And the question comes up time and again, you've only had two female winners in the history of the show. Why is that? You know, will there ever be a woman? Why are there so few women that win Top Chef? That's unfair. That's wrong. You're biased. Galicchio is masterminding the whole thing, whatever. People blame a million reasons, right? The producers put you... Of course not. None of that is true. And actually, the interesting part of what we do on Top Chef is twofold. One, we stack the deck for women. So the industry, we were just saying, the industry is something like less than 15% of professional cooks working in restaurant kitchens today are women. But we start the season, every season on Top Chef, 50-50.
Wow. Right.
Because we want to find as many great women cooks as we can. So it starts out actually disproportionate to the industry. And that's, for whatever reason, that's the way the cards fall. And the two women who have won on our show, Stephanie Izard and Kristen Kish, who are two extraordinary women, and I believe either of them could go head-to-head, if not annihilate, the 10 men who have won over the years. They are on par in every way. And there's actually several women who've been on the show who have come out of the show extraordinarily successful in their own right. But there is that kind of question of why, how does that happen? Why does that happen? And we're still trying to figure it out. I mean, I think it's all those things. I think that there is, I think there's less women in the industry, first of all, less women cooking in kitchens. So finding them to be on the show is harder.
Yeah.
So we're kind of looking a little bit deeper and, you know, specifically on Top Chef, it's not, you know, it's not about amateur cooks or women who aren't, it's about restaurant professionals. It's about being restaurant cooks. It's not about I would never be on Top Chef as a contestant. Someone who does, any of the three of us would never be, because we are not professional restaurant kitchen cooks. And it's hard to find really strong female chefs, not because they aren't capable, but for a million reasons, they leave the kitchen. Right. We all left I left the kitchen. We leave the kitchen before we make it to that level. And there's a lot of factors working against us to make that so. Childcare is a big part of it. You know, it takes 10 years to become a chef, if you're lucky. You know, from the time you go to culinary school or start working as an apprentice till the time you actually run a kitchen. Like, the word chef I use very specifically. I don't mean anyone working in kitchens is a chef. I mean the person who is the owner, the boss, running the kitchen. And so if it takes 10 years to become a chef and you start when you're 20, now you're 30, and life for women changes around those years if you choose that route. So there's a lot of obstacles that come up, that we come up against, that make it difficult to stay in kitchens working evenings, weekends, and holidays. And so that's why there's just a fallout at the higher levels of kitchens.
For sure.
I always kind of like play that game, and now I'm getting like really political, but
no, it's great. I think it's so important.
Like, can you name more than 5 female chefs who own their own restaurants in New York City? I can certainly name them in California, and I can name several in New York City, but it is hard at the top. I'm talking about the top.
And
of the
5 years
chain.
Ago, it would have been even harder.
Yeah, we're getting there.
Hopefully,
but it's a big conversation. Yeah.
No, I think you both bring up such important questions and questions that we don't necessarily have answers for. But it's so good that they're being asked and that they're being talked about, and that women like you are even thinking about the answers. I think,
and that you're asking.
Yeah. I have a long list of
and
more
the
things.
Cherry
that
bomb.
Right, cherry bomb. That's also thank God for cherry bomb. Yeah. That's, I think that Carrie and Claudia started something really big without really, I'm sure, any of us realizing it. I think,
like
that
you
it's
said, not intending to be political, doing what they do, but really asking the right questions.
Exactly.
Wonderful. My list of things you guys have in common goes on, and I'm going to email you both and give you the other things I came up with. But we are very sadly out of time. And before we go, in much lighter, much less political news, I have to do the cherry bomb rapid fire with both of you, which are the questions I ask every guest. And so no pressure, no worries. Just first thing that comes to mind. And let's see, Jasmine, I'll start with you. Sweet or salty?
Oh, salty.
Gail?
Salty. I mean, people really? Don't That's believe surprising. Me. Yeah. I know. People, yeah. It's a whole thing. I had a dessert show. I really do love dessert. But when I crave salty food.
Jasmine, what did you have for breakfast today?
A mini cheese bialy.
That sounds good.
That's a really good answer. I had half a buckwheat pancake and a banana with hazelnut butter on it.
That sounds good. Mm-hmm. That was actually my bonus question for you that I don't ask anyone else, but both of you being, I guess, Jewish Canadians, I wanted to know about Montreal bagel, New York bagel, or bialy.
Montreal bagel, 100%.
I'm going to go with the Toronto bagel.
Oh my God, Jasmine, we're going to have words.
I think we've had these words.
But do you see a difference between a Toronto and a New York bagel?
Yeah, you get it at the right place.
Okay, so we're going
to... On the next episode.
Yeah.
Smaller, firmer.
Okay. And there's Greif's, which is a whole other kind of bagel.
Smushy.
Right?
Yeah, no.
I think there should just be a whole season.
I know. We should clearly have a radio show.
I don't know if anyone will listen, but we'll have a good time.
Our moms.
My mom will listen, too. She's a big fan. I'm going to cut to my last question. Jasmine, what was your favorite meal when you were growing up?
Mac and cheese. Mm. My mom made good mac and cheese.
What about you, Gail?
God, that's hard. I'm trying to think. My mom made a lot of things. Like, I have very clear memories. I mean, really soft-boiled eggs with soldiers, I think, was like my favorite thing to eat growing up that I have a very clear memory
of. It's still one of your favorite things,
it
right?
Is.
I remember you writing
true.
About it. Mm-hmm. I love that. Thank you both so much for coming on today. I think we brought up a lot of really good stuff. I'm happy the conversation's happening. All Hotbread Kitchen information, including the green market schedule, stuff about the breads, everything, it's hotbreadkitchen.org. Twitter and Instagram are both Hotbread Kitchen. And Gail, you reside online at just gailsimmons.com, right?
Yeah, foodandwine.com too, perfect. Or wherever social media happens. But also just go to hotbreadkitchen.org.
Yeah, perfect. I like that. And as always, thank you everyone for listening. Tune in next Monday at 1 o'clock for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.